Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. I'm Ruth McKee, and joining me today is poet and novelist Theo Dorgan, whose new novel, Camarade, is out now with Mercier Press. Theo, I want to take you back to, I know you're a Cork man, you're born in Cork.
Yep.
I want to take you back there, basically, to your childhood and ask you about, yeah, just about your life and your reading life in particular back when you were a child, if you remember anything particular that stands out from then.
It sounds an odd thing to say, but I don't remember not being able to read. And my first paid job, actually, was for reading. A guy down the road from me, Jimmy Driscoll, he couldn't read. And his aunt used to bring him the Dandy and the Beano every Wednesday night. And I was paid a pineapple bar to read the comics to him. My first gainful employment, reading comics to Jimmy Driscoll.
What age were you then, Theo?
I suppose by then I was probably 5 or 6. But I know I was reading from about 4.
Okay. And you don't have any recollection of that?
I don't recall not being able to read. But that's maybe just, that's a fault in memory, obviously. Mm. There surely was a time when I was hardly born able to read.
Well, you never know.
Reading was my great salvation always. It was somewhere to go to where nobody else could come, but also it opened up the world. Mm. You know, you could be, growing up in the 50s in Ireland, you could be incredibly bored. But I was never bored. I was never bored in my life because there's always a book to go to. It could be anywhere.
I'm going to ask you a really annoying question because I know authors get asked this all the time, but I really have to know because I'm reading. And can you pronounce the title for me, by the way?
Camarade.
Camarade. Because I've been saying it all sorts of different ways, and I have to ask you, Camarade. The young boy in this, you know, I have to ask you. The young boy in this is his world is, there's a lot of books in his world also, and knowledge and a curiosity. Is there much of you in him?
There is, in the sense that the Blackpool I give him is the Blackpool I grew up in. And I was very, you see, it has only occurred to me, my last book, Once Was a Boy, basically was a recapitulation of my memories of primary school. That's a very crude way of putting it. But when those poems started to come in, I realized that I had a promise to keep, that as far back as I can remember, I'm in a situation, I'm saying, I must remember this. You will need to remember this. And you will need to remember this. It was always in the second person. And I'm wondering, who's telling me this? Who in there is telling me this? You will need to remember this. And I was quite astonished at what came back once the memories started coming. And so I had to give Joseph a locus. I had to give him somewhere to come from. And it became Blackpool. And there's an awful lot of the Blackpool of my childhood in it. How much there is of me, I don't know, except that he's a noticer. Mm-hmm, witness, mm-hmm. Notices things. And I suppose your sins catch up, which I've been saying for years to student pupils in workshops, that, for instance, that, you know, you will need to remember things. You will need to remember. You must store your memories. And also the business of making poems, and I suppose novels, is to feed memory, to feed the memories of others. Mm. And so that we're witnesses. Writers, I think, are witnesses. You pay witness to the world we find ourselves in. I didn't ask to be born. I'm certainly not asking to go. But as long as I'm here, my business is to pay attention. So I suppose there is that of me in Joseph, because Joseph is a noticer all his life. Mm.
But something that struck me was this, and you use a really lovely, just what you're talking about there about attention, you use a lovely phrase, and it's really interesting to me, doubling of attention, this idea of, and like you're both at the same time, both and neither, you're seeing it from a young boy, the young boy you still are somewhere, the older man, some other sense of observation in the psyche. It's really interesting.
I have an internal watcher. And maybe that's where our idea of eternity or of the eternal comes from, that this is a traveling point of view. And at the moment, it's in this body form. It's on this planet, in this place, at this time. It's a sense I've had all my life. And it can sometimes have be quite dissociative, you know. And one of the downsides of it is it can make you mistrust your own emotion. Because when you notice yourself in an emotional state, you wonder, is it an authentic feeling because you're noticing it? You know, that's something that's always intriguing. Who was very good at writing about that was Doris Lessing.
Right.
And I adore Doris Lessing. Actually, it's a bit immodest of me, but I must say that one of the great moments in my life was when Doris turned to Paula Meehan, my life partner, down in Cork, and said, I hope you don't mind, but I think I've fallen a little bit in love with you.
Oh.
She was at 84. Not bad. Good girl, Doris. She was wonderful. She's marvelous. I said the book that had the most effect on me in my life was probably The Four Gated City.
Okay.
Of hers. It's a most extraordinary and disturbing and unsettling book.
Yes, disturbing and unsettling. So that's, And tell me why. So when did you come to that?
72 or 73. I used to work on the buildings in London to put myself through college. And that was great crack. I thoroughly enjoyed that. But there was a place called the Village Bookshop on Regent Street. It had a little pond on the inside, a little pond inside the bookshop with a wooden ground you could sit on. And I remember that summer reading Carlos Castaneda and Doris Lessing for the first time. There might have been an encounter with a substance originating in Switzerland originally, but definitely the one thing that made the most impact on me was discovering Lessing and particularly The Four Gated City, because it explained something to me that I'd been experiencing but didn't understand, seeing things as other. She has a character who's dismissed as a psychiatric case because she sees the fox in people or the wolf in people, you know, or the timid deer in people. Sure, I thought that was how everybody saw everything, you know? And so there's the shock of recognition, and then there's the extraordinary provocation of saying the world you think you see is not the world that is. And how Lessing could navigate between those two domains. She was extremely shrewd on politics. Mm-hmm. But she always saw politics in terms of the intrinsic nature of the person's character.
And, you know, I'm just going to make a comparison to your novel here with everything that you've just been talking about there. Because when I started this, when I read the back of the book, I was okay, I think I know what this is going to be. It was not at all what I thought it was going to be.
It'd be a big disappointment to Mercer.
No. It is... So it's so good. I'm recommending it to people. I'm only halfway through. I really am. But that, because what you're saying there about politics is, it to me in this book, it is intrinsically about the people and the ambiguity of their beliefs and passions and drives and all the rest of it. But it makes it so, to me anyway, it made it so, it makes it so, yeah, that word you were talking about there, not other, but I feel it's really palpable to me anyway. And I'm not someone who would read political things with much appetite, but I find that this is really, I'm savouring this totally.
You know, Ruth, I think I always said to people, and then everybody may write things to find out what happened next. You know, there's never any great plan or anything. And then you give it out to the world and you listen carefully to what comes back.
Mm.
My experience. And a very dear friend said two things about the book that really struck me. One is that it's about people trying to live an ethical life. And the other is that it's a book about good men. There are strong and powerful and good women in it as well. But there are lazy assumptions at any given point in a culture. And one of the lazy assumptions in our time, which is very dangerous, is that politics is a game.
Mm.
And most people who are professional politicians, it is a game. And it's a game of I must prevail. But there's always been a strong strain of people for whom politics begins in ethics. What is the right thing to do? Who are the vulnerable? How do we protect them? And they can hide, if you like, or immerse themselves in different political formations in order to bring about practical results. But basically, the drive is not party. It's not gain. It's not ego satisfaction. It's an ethical impulse to try to do the right thing. And I was very proud of some of these characters, of how ethical they were. You know, the last time, after I'd finished this, I was back in Paris, and I was slightly discombobulated that I couldn't go and see the lads or the women, you know? They'd become so real to me.
Yeah.
And I mean, I could probably turn around from another angle and say, look, it's an attempt to reconcile my interest in writing per se and my interest in the political life. Understood as the ethical life, but sure, I don't know. It's a story.
It's a story, but at the same time, well, for me, I find myself, I'm waiting each time to come back to Paris and the 70-plus narrator, 70-plus narrator, what am I talking about here? An algorithm, Joseph. But I'm waiting to come back to now because I'm loving the, I suppose, like you talk at one point, there is one point where he talks about, I should say, there's a kind of a floundering, a moment of floundering, a moment of kind of mental darkness where he kind of goes, I don't know, I kind of, everything is going blurry and my place in the world even is unsure, just for a moment. And he says, you know, at times like that, I need to go and read a thriller or get into bed or do something. He's very no-nonsense about it, you know. But there is that sense of a sort of a veil somewhere off in the periphery. There's this veil and it's aging and all of that. And I'm absolutely fascinated by this. And I think it's, he writes about this with a lot of humour and it's like, catch yourself on, go for a walk, buy a baguette, you know, pour yourself a glass of wine. But there's also really...
You'd rather be terrified.
Pardon?
It's either that or be terrified.
Be terrified, yes. Yeah.
I have a friend who calls it circling the well. Circling the well and just get out and do something. Mm-hmm. He's learned something it took me a long time to learn, which is, you know, there's a certain brisk, no-nonsense response when everything becomes doubtful and doubted, and especially when you begin to doubt yourself. It's a kind of an existential, it's just this side of existential terror where we don't know what we are, who we are, where we come from, what we're doing here. I suspect, though I don't know for sure, because what do I know, that might be why I haven't bumped into Beckett beyond, and then let Beckett go. Uh-huh. Because it's the sort of thing that happens in cities, isn't it? You know, you bump into people. I remember Kieran Carty at Cannes. I used to run the Cork Film Festival. We were at Cannes for the festival picking films. And Kieran Carty describes bumping into Graham Greene on the Croisette. And he looks up and it's clear from his reaction. He says that Greene sees that he's been recognised. So Greene just goes, and Kieran bows gracefully as he would. And as he goes by, Green leans down and whispers, thank you.
Oh, that's lovely.
Isn't it? But it speaks as much to the grace of Kieran's character.
Oh, yes.
As the Greens. But, you know, why wouldn't you? I'm waiting for a plane in Sheremetyevo coming back from the Moscow Film Festival with Paddy Woodworth. And two tables away, morosely staring into space, waiting for his flight, is Gabriel García Márquez. You know, I remember, I think there might have been drink taking because I remember inviting him to visit Ireland, Europe's only third world country. I know.
Incredible.
There are things that are better off that remembering. But gosh, you know, that sense that exile is a natural, you know, we see exile always externally, but you can be in exile inside yourself.
Yeah, of course.
And Joseph is, in a sense, in exile inside himself. Perhaps more so when he's younger than when he's older, because he's older, he's physically in exile, so he has something to pin it to. But as a young man, he feels in exile from the life around him. He doesn't form attachments to too many people. And
then, sorry, carry on.
And he's spending so much time with men much older than men who've had hard, difficult things to do in their lives. Mm-hmm. Amiable Shawnee, who signed execution orders.
Yeah.
His father, grandfather rather, who fought in three wars. You know this. You know when you're writing something and suddenly something comes up on the screen or on the page, however you do it, and that really surprises you, but clicks into place. It's when the grandfather, he asks the grandfather why he didn't take part in the Civil War.
Oh, yeah.
Says, I could not shoot the men I fought.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That was a shock to me when that sentence came up because I saw how necessary it was to realize that there were many.
Yes.
Fought in the War of Independence, who turned away like that.
And not so much of his character as well, that shows you so much of who he is.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think they're a great bunch of people all together. I loved, and as I said, that's, I was disappointed that they weren't around. You know, it's a bit baffling.
Well, there's that. You were talking there about exile, but I love the, there's a line in the book, something along the lines of, you know, when you oh, I'm going to misquote it now, but it's living in another, when you live in another language, you live in another world. I love that. How you become a different person. There's a different part of you that is,
yeah,
maybe was always there, but is brought to life.
Well, Irish English is particular in itself because I think because the ghost presence of the syntax of Gaelic in it, of Gaelge in it. And Gaelge has a great love of the conditional tense, mm-hmm. straightforward Anglo-Saxon like nouns and definites. So we're always slightly uneasy or over-expressive in English. But we're very body conscious, we're tight. But if I'm in France, suddenly all the...
Yeah, it starts to...
Or in Greece, and the gestures come out, you know. Mm. You pick up the card and you realize that every language is, it's not just a system of signs and notations. It's something you live in,
mm-hmm.
live in a language. And the great joy of other languages is that you can say things in a language that maybe another language doesn't allow you to say. There's a great word for someone who's mean-spirited and low and capable of nasty things and doesn't enjoy life and is basically bitter. All these things are in the word surach.
Surach.
That's Gaelge. Surach. Dinas surach.
That's great.
You know? And even the sound of it, the feel of it in your mouth.
Yeah, it's...
Surach. Astinas surach. Or, you know, in English you say, ah, he's bluff and hearty. The word sounds give you the picture of it.
Yeah.
Wittgenstein said, probably wasn't. I always get my attributions wrong. The limits of my language are the limits of my world. But it's also true. The reverse is also true. The limits of my world are the limits of my language. The less I see of the world, the less I'm present to the world, the more impoverished my language is.
Was language and learning languages always in your life? Was it there when you were going to college? Was it something?
I did most of my schooling to Irish. I learned Latin through Irish.
You learned Latin through Irish.
So it was an all. You have to. It's a strange thing. It's very much a working class corner of Cork. It's very much working class school. Our fathers drove trucks, or worked on Dunlops, or Fords, or swept the streets. And our mothers, very often, like my mother, worked in factories, and that. Our school was all Irish. So I had the two languages always, and I could switch backwards and forwards between the two. And it gave me a strong sense that you have different recourses in different languages. If you want to say something, you can go to one place in English, you can go to a slightly different place in Irish. And so really, I just have Irish, English, and French, smattering of Greek, smattering of Latin. But if I were to find myself in the Urals and walk to Leningrad, Petersburg, whatever we're calling it these days. By the time I got there, I know I'd be speaking Russian.
Okay.
So immersion.
Yeah. You think there's something, I think there is something maybe in the brain at an early age, if it's kind of open, it's like music or something,
adaptive creatures. Very adaptive. Look how quickly a four-year-old picks up an iPad. Mm. You know? And it's because they're not afraid of making a mistake. There's no grammar police. There's no finger touch police. If a child makes a mistake with a laptop or on an iPad or a phone, they'll just go and try something else.
Afraid.
We're at my age, you're afraid you'll crash the whole system if you you know?
I love the Paris in this book. I love Paris in this book. It's not the Paris that, I don't know. It's the griminess or something, or the just smells of petrol and the smell of rotting fruit or something. I don't know. It was just there.
It's a real city.
Yeah.
It's the denseness of it. But also I can think of few moments where I felt as comfortable in the world as walking through Paris at night and looking up and seeing the apartments, first floor, second floor apartments, with a kind of golden yellow light.
I love that.
And walls of books And imagining the life being lived in.
Oh, I love that. I love that feeling. I love that feeling anywhere, that feeling. That, yeah.
An 80-year-old woman perfectly made up and dressed and some, coming from the bakery with a loaf under her arm and nodding very precisely to her neighbours as she goes by, seeing things like that, you know?
Yeah.
But Paris in particular, I remember being astonished first time I went to Berlin at how flat and green it is. I was expecting something like Paris, you know, with the big close walls of buildings and so on. The density of life being lived.
Yes.
You know? And all cities have their signature. Like New York, you always feel they've been swept up and away, up too high and away from you that you can't connect with. But Paris manages a kind of an intimate grandeur, you know?
Yeah, I like Paris. That.
Of course, I don't go to the banlieue, to the suburbs where the immigrants are warehoused and...
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't see everything in your life. And I probably have an idea. I'm sure Parisians think it's a sentimental picture of their city. But, you know, Dubs have a sentimental picture of Dublin too, you know.
We do, Cork,
as
Oh, God. Now, if we start you on Cork, we'll be here for... I know.
You live in Dubai, you can live in Dusseldorf, you can live in Denver, Colorado. But if you move out of Cork and live in Dublin... they never forgive you.
No. I read something you wrote about. You said you'd, how did you put it? You moved away. You moved away from Cork, but you always
carried. Yeah, I never left Cork. I just live elsewhere.
Just live elsewhere. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, that's a very...
That's true of all of us. And you know, you leave your childhood. You don't ever really leave your childhood. You just live elsewhere.
That's very true. And I know you've written as well before about that, just that. And it's in Camerade as well, the kind of the search for other, not search for otherness, but a feeling of being at home in otherness, and you can be yourself in otherness, that you can, you know, that you feel a certain freedom in it.
Yeah, that's why I hope there's some sort of sense of play in the book, you know. You can play. You can play in Paris. You know, you can bump into Joseph if you feel like, and when you're walking down the street or having a coffee. You know.
Oh, it's marvelous, and it's full of sort of lovely little surprises and little. It's just, you know, it's I suppose the way I'm talking about it seems very, very hefty, but it's because it deals with ideas that I absolutely intrigue me. I've always been fascinated by this idea of observation, because I have that thing in my mind. I always think, God, is there something wrong with me? Why am I detached from this moment? I'm in this moment, enjoy this moment. You know, I'm in it, I'm still observing it, and it's very hard. And I think that's why a lot of us maybe, you know, we drink or we do other things to kind of almost, you know, quench that, so that you can just try to calm that observation.
Yeah, because I remember at that time now when I discovered Doris Lessing, for instance, you know, let's just say that LSD was around the place.
Right? Yeah.
Let's just say it was in the air. But even then, you're tripping. You're watching yourself. You're noticing what's happening to you. And I think you either you're born with that observer and you give credit to it, or you suppress it. And it's amazing how many people suppress it. It's a free gift.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are frightened by it, I suppose.
Yes.
It frightens me sometimes when it makes me doubt the authenticity of my own feelings. I think I did in the book, I have the kind of person who just looks just a little too long at a traffic accident.
Oh.
Taking it in, putting all the picture together instead of being horrified or terrible, you know.
Yeah.
The watcher.
Mm-hmm.
Watcher. Mm-hmm. But you know, this is a very intriguing conversation, because a part of me is stepping aside and then thinking, yeah, that's in a lot of poems actually, not really. So you're talking about this, I was still...
Yeah, you're still observing the comment about observation, I know. I think it's...
6 weeks overdue for a haircut, you know. And
it's no... The one time I feel sometimes, but only if you're in a certain, but I think the only time, well, for me anyway, that it can be subdued a little bit is when you're singing or playing music, when you're absolutely 100% inhabiting something. But even then it can happen, because I remember playing with somebody and he said, I was away off thinking about, you know, what I was going to do next week when I take the car in, and he was away playing a song and he was away off thinking, but there is still, you know, but sometimes you can just switch it off. Oh, not very well. I just mean like singing or being, when you're in when you're, you know, and I've heard it from other musicians too, that sometimes that you can literally lose that chatter.
Or you can go away. You can just be gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or I'll use the word scent. I have a scent.
Yeah.
And of course, we do this in order to give people the option of that experience. You know, I remember in a thing I was doing for Fighting Words once, I was looking at people trying to say, look, what I want you to do is send me there.
Mm.
And I didn't know I was going to say that. And then I realized, but that's what I've been trying to do. Send me there. While you're reading this, I want you to be in this elsewhere.
That's nice.
You know, this elsewhere, this augmentation. You know, it's not an alternative to your life. It's an augmentation. And it only makes the sense that you can bring to it as well.
I love that word, elsewhere.
Business, isn't it?
Yeah. It's nice. I'll have to bring you back to books here before we go. I'm gonna start asking before we do, I do want to ask you this because it kind of touches on what we've just been talking about. And you know, I've asked this to other people before, I'm just interested to know what you think. You know, when you hear from a therapist or you hear from a philosopher, whatever, that you're not your thoughts, and you're not your thoughts, you can observe your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also hear you're not your feelings. You're not the anger you're experiencing, you experience the thought, then you experience the emotion. But if you're not your thoughts and I'm not my emotions responding to my thoughts, then what is the substance? I am actually going to ask you this question. So few.
You answer. I'm mad.
I just can't, but is it, you know, do you know, is there something you were talking about that part of yourself that, you know,
the best way I can answer that is to ask a different kind of question.
Right.
Is Joseph real?
Mm.
Michael John real? All right. And we have a kind of binary way of thinking in the West. You know, we have the world of emotional forms and we have the world of material forms. You know, there's a table and there's a thought about the table. That's kind of, but there's in Sufism, there's a proposition of a third domain, the domain of imaginal forms, where something that the imagination creates actually exists. And think of that moment in Hamlet, where we learn that Ophelia is dead. And you feel a pang of sadness for her. And you have to say that 400 odd years ago, a middle-aged man with dyspepsia, his breath stinking of sour wine, came home in the dark, lit a candle, dipped the feather of a bird in a paste with oak gall and juniper and charcoal and scratched words on a piece of dry sheepskin that you and I couldn't read now. And as a direct result, 400 years later, you're sitting at home with your feet up on the dog, a glass of whiskey beside you in front of the fire, weeping for Ophelia. Now that's very mysterious.
Isn't it?
Yeah. And it can only happen if there is a sense in which Ophelia exists.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the world is peopled with actual things, and it's foolish to say it isn't. And it's peopled, but it's also people with imagined things, you know. And our business is to bring things out. Coleridge defines primary imagination and a secondary imagination in the Biographia Literaria. It says the secondary imagination consists of the ceaseless recombination of known fixities and definites in order to produce a pleasant sensation, words to that effect. It's the ceaseless recombination of it. But then he says the primary imagination, you're sitting back now, this is a heavy one.
Okay, go.
It's the participation in the finite world of the infinite I am.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
But you
know, if you let that, that's been percolating in my mind for 50 years. And yeah. I still haven't quite figured it out. I just have a sense I know it.
Yes.
But if you make it well enough, it will endure. Dr. Zhivago endures because Pasternak wrote him so well. Anna Karenin exists because Tolstoy wrote her so well. The child in Frank O'Connor's An Only Child exists because he wrote him so well. He imagined him so powerfully. So if you think of the imagination as an actual shaping force, an actual, not an imagined force, but an actual force. But all kinds of responsibilities come with it as well, because you can imagine the necessity to exterminate an entire people.
Mm.
You know, and if Netanyahu can imagine strongly enough with the force, I suppose, of an entirely depopulated Gaza, then he can make it happen. And that's the terrifying side of the imagination, you know. Imagination has a dark power as well. But, you know, look, 7 head cases invented the Irish Republic. Do you know? I mean, what were they? You know, a schoolmaster, a tobacconist, 3 poets. And they imagined the Republic, and there it is because they dared to imagine it. And I think it's that's the word, isn't it? They dared to imagine.
Imagine.
Most people. I remember myself, my friend Michael Hannigan, a dear friend, looking around the classroom the day we were breaking up after the Leaving Cert. And realizing in an incoherent kind of way that at least 2/3 of them had already given up. All they wanted was to get a safe, secure job, be troubled until the end of their days. You know, they wanted to go to matches or play hurling, or maybe they were going to become set dancers, or maybe they were going to become, you know, conductors of public affairs. But really, they were afraid. They didn't dare. They'd given up daring. They just wanted to be safe.
Yeah.
And to dare to imagine. I mean, I think that's why books have endured for so long, because every book you read is a dare to your imagination. Every good book you read is a dare to imagine. I remember reading this when the book that really, that first book that influenced me in my childhood was The Wind in the Willows.
Mm.
And for 2 reasons. One is, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn spoke to some part of me that I hadn't yet met. It's a kind of a mystical encounter with the, it's an encounter with the numinous world in the English pastoral, a very pastoral, but a sense of mystery at the heart of things that can't be spoken but can be felt. And that was the first time I'd encountered that feeling. I was very impressed that it was words brought it out. I was noticing that if you write the right words in the right way, you can bring up this feeling. And then there's a scene where Mole comes home for Christmas, and they're all busy bustling around and getting in potted meat and shrimps and ginger beer and blah blah, and of course it's achingly English, even though Graham was Scottish. But I remember writing an essay one afternoon in school. It was an anomalous day because we were told to write an essay in class, and I deliberately set out to try to create the feeling by moving words around on the page that that passage had evoked in me, and realizing, writing is something you do. And you can decide what it you wanted to do. And I remember reading it back. This was the key thing, I think.
Uh-huh.
Reading it back to myself afterwards and feeling from the piece of writing the thing I'd been trying to create.
Yeah.
You know, able to stand outside it.
Yeah.
So even though it's a twee book in many ways, and it's a grotesquely sentimental book in many ways, it just happens that that's the book that did it for me.
It's formative, yeah.
I read Treasure Island and Coral Island. I was much more impressed with Coral Island because it took me there. I knew that in Treasure Island, these are all made up places. But in Coral Island, I felt I was there.
Okay.
The island. So all that goes in and you don't know it's going in. It's only lifetime later you discover.
And did you, that was when maybe you were trying to be like eliciting that feeling and reading the little passage back, and you kind of go, oh, so did you build on that? Did that keep going, or was that just like a little sort of, was that like a little illumination and then a pause, or was it just something that was organic?
I just carried on. I mean, you know, there were games of hurling to be played on the street, and we climbed and heads to break and go into Northern Infirmary to get stitches put in, you know, and all the usual things of boyhood, childhood. But I knew always I was going to be a writer. It came as a terrible shock to discover that writing wasn't as easy as reading. There was work involved. That came as a terrible shock, and that you could fail. Because I never had any bother with the school essays. I'd put it off and put it off and put it off. And then suddenly Sunday night, I'd dash it out And more often than not, I'd have to stand up in front of the class and read it the following morning, you know. And that was just part of the deal. I think it helped in a different way too, because I was classic material for bullying. Second smallest guy in the class after Pat Cohan. And
you remember?
I remember everything. You know, prone to bullying. But they were afraid of language. They were afraid of what I might say to them or whatever it was. I got very little hassle. And I think it was to do with command of language. You know, I still remember Brendan O'Neill, if he's alive and still, pushing our bikes up Fair Hill on our way to games, turning around and saying to me, "Dorgan boy, you talks too much." And realizing he's absolutely right, I do. Just being drunk with words, you know.
I can't believe you remember the names so clearly. The smallest boy in the class.
Well, Rosa Beckett says, "I remember everything. Nothing."
So Theo, I'm going to race you forward to your college years, because you mentioned earlier something about working. I didn't know this about you. So you worked on building sites to pay your own fees or to pay your way through.
Yeah. Well, I was the first in my extended family to only the second or third in the whole extended family of cousins and uncles, blah, 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 to get a leaving cert, and certainly the first to go to university.
Right.
And we were, I call us O'Malley's children, the great Donogh O'Malley, the heroic Donogh O'Malley, who introduced free secondary education. His transformative effect on Ireland is still being felt. But there were 4,000 students in UCC when I went there, and there were 27 from the north side.
Wow.
And we all knew each other across faculties and ages, but there were that so few. But at the same time, just ahead of us, a couple of years ahead of us, were Michael Davitt, Noel Linney Gonal, Liam O'Merla, Gabriel Rosenstock, the Inti poets, that marvelous thing, revolutionary explosion in Irish language poetry that was Inti. You know, when they launched the first edition of that journal, there were 1,000 people in the Silver Springs Hotel that night for the launch of a poetry journal in Irish. And then 2 or 3 years later came another generation in English. Tom McCarthy, Sean Dunn, Greg O'Donoghue, Maurice Reardon, Jerry Murphy, and a little behind Greg Delante, Liam Duvall, who became William Wall for reasons that are still opaque.
I didn't know that.
I think it was something to do with, my recollection may be at fault, and if it is, he'll forgive me, but I seem to remember a conversation where he said he stopped being Liam Duvall so that in case people would think he was a Provo sympathiser by using the Irish form of his name. Anyway, as I say, memory is imperfect. It's exact but imperfect. And we had Sean Lucy was our professor, incredibly supportive, and John Montague had just come to teach.
Wow.
Just as O'Riordan and O'Tuama had helped to nurture the Irish language poets just before us, they helped to nurture us. And I had a classic Dossard's degree, English and philosophy, chosen so that I wouldn't be boxed into having to make vocational choice and get a job. And they were incredibly kind to us. Our teachers were incredibly kind. We were wayward. You have to remember, this is rock and roll, flower power, just after Paris 68. We were, you know, and I suppose there was a kind of an independent university inside the university. You walked into the rest of the campus kitchen and someone said, "Have you read this? Have you read this?" I mean, the extraordinary fermentation of ideas. This is the time of Ivan Illich and Paulo Freire and de-schooling society and the pedagogy of the oppressed, you know. We'd all been formed. Our idea of being a student had been formed by what we were reading in school, or seeing in school of Paris and Berlin in 68 and Berkeley and so on, you know. And we were the first world generation, you know. We weren't imprisoned in any idea of just, we had a more expansive idea of being Irish than our predecessors, but we weren't imprisoned in the smaller idea of it. You know, you just stuck a guitar in your back, a sleeping bag under your arm, and you headed off anywhere. And you were sure you'd have a bed for the night. You'd find a kindred spirit, you know. So all of that was happening. And I discovered to my shock that I was writing poems. This was unexpected. And might have been partly due to the influence of my friendship with Thomas McCarthy, who's, I think, an absolutely wonderful poet. Although I have a bone to pick with him about his memoirs, but that's another story.
Ooh.
No, it's harmless. No, it's just harmless. It's just I get a lot of slagging at home for a passage where we're at a party in Montague's, and I'm there with whatever girlfriend I had that week or that day. Tom McCarthy makes some remark about this, and Evelyn Montague says, "Will you see, Theo is a honeypot for the thinking woman." So I had to put up a thing called honeypot for months after the management here read that, you know.
Oh, I love it. Honeypot for the thinking woman. Seriously, that's great.
Well, that was a long time ago. A very long time ago. No, Tom was a great influence on me, and the seriousness with which Tom, well, I think he was still a student, had a line in a poem that has affected me profoundly ever since. He has one called Daedalus the Maker. And at some stage, Daedalus, the father of Icarus, the great artificer of Minoan Crete. And he says his purpose is to lay art anonymously at Earth's altar. To lay art anonymously at Earth's altar. Reading that and thinking, oh, this is serious stuff. And, you know, I sometimes don't do that many workshops. When I do, I'd always ask, which would you rather? To write a poem so good that your name had been forgotten. The poem will be kept, but it will not be, it'll be forgotten that you wrote it. And if they don't say, I take that deal immediately, I know that they're wasting their time. They should go and do something else. I mean, I take that deal in a heartbeat.
God, yeah.
Ewan McCall, there's a great story about Ewan McCall, the great folk singer. He's in Dublin for a gig and he wakes up on a Saturday morning and the radio is on. And the radio says, "Now, coming up now to the news, but just before that, just time for one more song. Here's a great song from the traditional repertoire." And on came Dirty Old Town. And he levitated out of the bed and he floated around Dublin for the afternoon, 3 feet off the ground. And what he said was, "I had written a song so good that my name had been forgotten." Now, any real writer would take that deal anytime.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wasn't Tom very bright to have come up with that line so young? Still a student, you know?
So you're in your 20s, but then, yeah, sometimes there is that sort of weird flash. Why? And that, you said you just started then and it was a surprise. And do you remember how it came to you or how it happened? And it was a hard question. It's, you know, we're talking about something quite sort of spiritual really, but how did it land, or what was your first, can you remember?
Well, I was tipping about with things, but where it landed was something I can't really tell. I can't remember. Like, it wasn't there, and then somehow it was there, and it gradually slid into, what was it, Kavanagh said, "I dabbled in verses and found they had become my life." I did many other things with my life, but there was always the pull to the point, pull to the point, pull. I mean, you know, it was quite some time before I started publishing. And I'd never any huge interest in publishing in magazines. It made me laugh when I was director of poetry and to see people very earnestly looking for advice on how to develop their career in poetry. Career in poetry, dear Jesus. What an absurd idea, you know? You have a life in poetry. Mm. But I don't know, maybe poetry is what pulls all the different bits together. It could be. It's still a mystery to me, and I keep coming back to workshops for some reason because it's the only time I ever focus on it as opposed to getting on with it. But I do say that if we don't write the poems write us. and your business is to learn your trade so well that when it comes, you can capture it.
You can handle it.
No, yeah. Gonla has a lovely poem. Kuramaganak snaver srotnatangan. You know, I put my poem afloat on the stream of language. And that's where craft comes in. You have to build a craft. With craft, you have to build a craft. I like the double.
Mm-hmm.
Watertight and buoyant.
Mm.
Will keep the poem, whatever that is, alive. And the machine in words is the crafted vessel.
Yeah.
The poem is that's a profoundly unmodern thought. The idea that the poem is autonomous and that it exists in itself for its own sake.
Mm.
I have to say, it's been my experience. I make a poem and it has a spark of life in it, but it can be years before I understand what it was about. And to be honest, that never bothered me in the least, you know. Make it, finish it, let it off, let it find its own way in the world, you know. When I see people chasing reputation or making oracular pronouncements and getting on with it, you know. There's a great story. You remember Artie McGlynn, great musician from the north. Artie's a great musician in the folk idiom, but he also played with Van Morrison.
Oh, right, yes.
Yeah. And he was in a pub in Cork one day, and a fellow put a pint in front of him. Says, Jesus, Artie, it must be terrifying playing with Van. What do you mean? He said, well, we've all seen him, like, shouting at the band on stage and everything. I said, what's your talking about? He says, Van nods at me and I play a bit, then Van nods at me and I stop. Simple. Entirely oblivious of the fact you had to be as good as Artie for it to be that simple.
Yeah, I love that.
Van nods at me and I play, but then Van nods at me and I stop. It's like the apocryphal story about the brothers Goncourt who set out to write a novel about the French Revolution. And one brother writes two sentences, the other looks over his shoulder and says, on fait c'est tout. That's it. So they abandon the book. And the two sentences were, first thing we do, we hang all the lawyers. Next thing we do, we hang all the priests. So that's it. You know? That's the French Revolution. There's no need to write anymore.
Oh, and what do you, well, obviously you read a lot of poetry, but one of the questions that I'm not going to get to ask you all the questions I want, but, and I wish I could, but it's about if there's a book, maybe it is a volume of poetry, I don't know, but if there's a book that you revisit and have revisited throughout your life, like a book that's just been with you or will stay with you or that you go back to or that's, you know, that's your companion.
Dear God.
I know, it's awful, isn't it?
I it's more that I go back to certain writers. I go back to Robert Graves a lot.
Okay.
Graves is the master craftsman. And nobody has evoked the elsewhere better than Graves does in English poetry. And it's a very funny thing. You see the academic surveys, English poetry in the 20th century, or this, that, and usually with a colon and another half title. They never mention Graves, except in passing. But every good poet I've ever met has always name-checked Graves.
Can you remind me of some of his poetry? I'm getting confused with Blake.
The White Goddess would be his great masterpiece of misdirection. Okay, Dance of Words. To make the move, you must move. To make the move, you must start from lightning, and not attempt to forecast the rhythm. Rely on chance, or so-called chance, till lightning interpenetrates the dance. Grant them their own traditional steps and postures, but see they dance it out again and again until only lightning is left to puzzle over, the choreography plain and the theme plain.
Now, I don't know why, if I got shivers because you have a lovely voice or if I got shivers because some of those lines, but that was very shivery. It's back to what, sorry, go on.
Another point is she tells her love, while half asleep in the dark hours, in half words whispered low, as the earth turns in her winter sleep and puts out flowers, and puts out grass and flowers, despite the snow, despite the falling snow.
That's
perfection. Two short poems.
Gosh.
A Graves is always worth revisiting.
And That first poem was very much what you were talking about, you know, when you're trying to sort of reveal a poem that already exists or that is autonomous. But that idea of the lightning and...
Make the move, you must start from light and not attempt to...
It's beautiful.
Rely on chance or so-called chance to lightning interpenetrates. Mm-hmm. I think poems intend themselves and you either succeed or fail in capturing them and putting them down. A very early poem called 4 a.m. Jazz on the Radio. And it's an oblique attempt to say to people that, look, poem comes in like music heard from another room. A snatch, and you must be there for it.
Be ready.
Paula, my dear Paula, says that, you know, it's up to the muse whether you get a poem or not, but it helps to sit at your desk every day so she knows where to find you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And at the risk of being disgustingly sentimental, being perceived as terrifyingly sentimental, book I've been reading a lot at the moment is Paula's selected, The Solace of Artemis.
Yes.
I'm still in awe of what she does. It's ridiculous, but...
How is that when you are so close with someone in other aspects? What is that like then, to read her words?
Nobody ever, we're each other's hard, toughest reader. If I think something is done and I show it to Paul and she says, no, not there, I know she's right. And vice versa, I'll see it in her. So the way we stay sane is we're ruthless about the craft, each to the other. I had a poem when we weren't long together, only a year or two. I had a poem that John Banville had taken for the Times. And he was a hard man to please, and people had been kind and said they liked it. I know a few people who'd cut it up, put it on the fridge, but I knew there was something wrong. I could not for the life of me tell you what was wrong with it. 16 lines. So I took it up one day and showed the poem, said, listen, there's something wrong here. And she looked at it. Ah, yes. Grabbed the pen and scratched out the first 9 lines. Said, that's only throat clearing.
So far, that's just, yeah.
But the best bit is I saw immediately, that's it, you're right. And ever since then, I've become a most ruthless reader of poems. And, I'm like, I'm a high-speed surgeon. Show me a poem and I say, well, no, that verse actually should be the second verse, not the fourth. And and people kind of look at you as if you perform something. Surgeons learn how to use the knife. So we've been very good for each other in that way, but we're completely different people.
Mm.
And
you're very different writers.
Different preoccupations entirely as writers, except the only thing is that it has to move. It has to, in both senses, it has to be alive on the page as well. But otherwise, we might as well be total strangers in one way. And 35 years.
Yeah, it works. It works.
Yeah. She's very patient.
Well, you'll have to tell her that my daughter read her poetry for Leaving Cert and has continued to read her poetry, absolutely adores her. I'm sorry, but when I said I was talking to you, Theo, I was like, you know, have you heard of Theo? Dorgan Lisi's 18, which is 19. Yeah, and I said, he's married to Paula Meehan. Sorry, but... Yeah.
It's the fate of men in the 21st century.
I know. Well, you're the honeypot for the thinking women, you see.
I have to remember that was a very long time.
Well, I don't know.
But, listen, before Paula was, you know, had this big set of poems on the Leaving Cert, she had just one poem on first a couple of years ago. And some of the local kids here, some of the girls, they came up to her, Paula, is that really your poem on the Leaving Cert? And she said, yeah, I'm afraid so, you see, because she thought she's part of the persecution, you know, by being curriculum. And she said, oh, yeah, we love it. Thanks very much. Yeah, it's lovely and short.
Short.
That's her favorite review, you know.
There you go.
But she listen, when she was on there, they were manifesting. They were having seance circles around the country with candles that she'd come up, you know. It was gas.
That's madness, isn't it? Yeah. So I don't know if you're going to answer this question because a lot of people don't. but it really isn't meant with any any ill will. And it's about leaving. Yeah, it's about leaving a book behind to burn. And I know what that conjures up, especially these days. But
No, there's no book I'd burn. I mean, I'd burn an old railway timetable, maybe, or a phone book. But even the worst book in the world, I couldn't bring myself to burn it because of the historical associations with burning books. But there are an awful lot of books I despise. And, they wouldn't give them the time of day. Mostly, actually, quite a lot of them are so-called self-help books.
Oh, pop psychology. Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, I think they're very dangerous, and they give people both a false steer and a false hope.
Mm.
And I think they're very dangerous. But the really dangerous ones are the How to Succeed in Business by Crushing the Faces of Everybody Who Works for You.
Yeah.
All of those. I wouldn't burn them, but if they got burned by accident, I wouldn't weep.
You wouldn't weep. We wouldn't mourn them. Okay, that will absolutely do, 100%. And is there something that you would say from your house that is not a dog or a cat or a beloved pet or a person or a book, but something else?
I think my laptop, my whole laptop in it. Do you know, I mean, this seems very, I'm very bad at packing things up. And I don't trust the cloud at all.
Oh, I was going to say, have you saved to the cloud? Because it's not trustworthy, because I lost a whole lot of stuff recently, even though it was saved. So,
I'm sitting here, and when you ask the question, I'm conscious that I have an external hard disk and a cupboard up above my head here, and it's time I got it down. Saving things. I do save things onto memory sticks, manuscripts, as I'm working on them. You know,
right.
But of course, you have to be able to find the memory stick. I think I know where the one with Joseph's book. This was originally, Camarade was originally called Joseph's book. And then Joe O'Connor came out with the book of Joseph, so I couldn't use it really. I think it was Dee Collins in Mercer came up with Camarade.
Camarade. Are we supposed to roll the R's there, or is there Camarade? Camarade.
See, the problem is, I like the word comrade, but it's over defined by its.
It's yes.
It's historical associations.
It is a weighty word.
Whereas comradeship is a marvelous concept. You know, it's more than just friendship, and camaraderie is a very fine word. You know. But I'm resigned to the fact that people are going to call it camarade or camaradi, but that's all right. I don't mind.
But it plays into other languages as well, doesn't it?
Yeah,
could you tell our listeners anyway a little bit about the premise, but just a little background to it before, because you're going to read for us, aren't you?
Joseph grows up as an orphan. He's reared by his grandfather, who commanded a flying column in the War of Independence, refused to join in the Civil War, fought in Spain with the Republican forces, fought in France with the resistance. So his father is an ethical resistor, his grandfather rather. The 1956-62 border campaign starts up, and this young branchman the special branch called to the grandfather's house and say, are you going to get involved? And he says, no, absolutely not. And it's nonsense. But the young branchman who comes with the older man takes an irrational hatred of Joseph, assaults a young woman friend of his in order to get at him, and Joseph shoots him. So now Joseph has to be got offside, and he's sent to Paris to an old resistance and Spanish Civil War comrade of his grandfather's, and he ends up spending the rest of his life in Paris. Mm. Is he in exile, or has he found where he was meant to be? I spent a lot of time puzzling that one out myself. But he resists, and I think quite rightly, the idea that a solitary life is necessarily a lonely life. He doesn't marry. He has one great love affair, which blows up in him. He tells us in passing lots of small affairs. But he spends his life in a solitary kind of way. But he's entirely content with that. And the whole culture is against the idea that you can be content to be solitary. So he has friends and he has comrades. And that's enough for him. And he has himself. And he spends his life among people who are politically active because they're ethically persuaded something has to be done to do the right thing. They're not professional politicians. They're involved in politics because that's how you if you want to do something to improve the world, it's called politics, where it's rooted in ethics rather than ambition or party loyalties. And he loves Paris. And I mean, somebody said to me, this is a love affair to two great places, Cork and Paris. And I'm certainly not going to argue with that. All things considered, I wonder if shooting that policeman made me the man that I am. On the Rue Mouffetard this morning, there was a man who reminded me for a fleeting moment of Sam, that gaunt, scribed face, now so world famous. I felt my hand rise unbidden in greeting, but the fellow turned away, a defeated slump in his shoulders that somehow irritated me. I miss my upright friend. Once over whiskey, I asked him how it was that he flew free. Long silence then. I suppose I just refused. That cold, blank stare. Then, unexpectedly, he reached across and squeezed my arm. We veterans. We come to our lives in different ways, those of us who are forced, shocked, or tricked into waking. I mean, of course, our real lives. But very few people have real lives now, by which I mean lives over which they deliberate, lives they are prepared to answer for at the bar of extinction. I've been awakened myself for what seems, when I think of it, a very long time. Whether this is good or bad, I cannot say. I have been, I think, exceptionally lucky. Taking all in all, I have had exactly the life I was made fit for. From time to time, I have met others like me. People, for instance, who stare quietly for perhaps a fraction too long at what prompts an immediate emotional response in others. A car crash, a lover's quarrel in public, the corpse of an acquaintance. I used to think of us as hungry souls, somehow defective in empathy. Not so, I eventually learned. Not so at all. What wakes us? Some very few, it seems, are born fully awake. I have seen infants in the Jardin de Luxembourg who could chill you with a look. I have felt that chill, then that sudden vertigo of mutual recognition. Always I hurry by. Some others, and here I include myself, are woken by chance or so-called chance, generally, it seems, by some irrevocable act or gesture, a moment of absolute commitment to anything. It can be anything. As long as one commits, as long as the act is irrevocable, cannot be unmade, cannot be explained away. And therefore I begin. All things considered, shooting that policeman was very likely what made me the man that I am.
You've been listening to Theo Dorgan, whose novel Kamerad is out now with Mercier Press. See you all next time.